Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimaginedonline.org, sparking the evolution of education choice. On this episode, senior writer Lisa Bowie talks with Eric Oglesby, director of the Founders Program at the Drexel Fund. Dr. Oglesby joined Drexel in July 2021 after guiding River Montessori High School, located in South Bend, Indiana, to a successful launch in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. As a co-founder of the school, Dr. Oglesby received a Drexel Founders Program Fellowship. Prior to helping launch River Montessori, he worked as a tenured university professor, served as a development director at a private pre-K through grade 8 school, and launched a consortium of Montessori schools. He earned his PhD in general linguistics from Indiana University in Bloomington.
Well, hi, Eric. We're so glad to have you here. And just start by telling me about your current role at the Drexel Fund.
Yeah, so my current role at the Drexel Fund is I'm the director of the Founders Program. And what that means is that, well, at the Drexel Fund, we have lots of different ways where we try to partner with people to help move them to the next step in opening a private school. And one of those ways is our Founders Program, which is a one-year fellowship for folks who are just a little over a year away from being able to start their own school. And what the fellowship does is it provides them a stipend to where they get to work full time to get their school open. And then they also get a learning plan budget that allows them to go visit other high performing schools that have models that are similar to the one they're opening, even ones that are very different, just to see what are the characteristics of high performing schools that they can carry back and put into their own school. And there's also a cohorted experience. And so as the director right now, for example, I'm working with four different fellows that we on a monthly basis are meeting together as a group in person or virtually, where everyone's learning more about how do you construct school boards? How do you do fundraising? How do you do budgets? It's really just a fellowship that's designed to help move people across the finish line to getting their school open. Also, as director of the Founders Program, I help with our early stage work, which is folks who are just at the idea process of a school and are figuring out, how do I even start down the road? And so we have periodic information sessions that people can attend where they get to learn about the pillars of school startup. And then they also get an opportunity to then attend workshops we have in some of these different areas of like fundraising and budgets, these things that come up every time in the school startup process.
I imagine with education choice legislation passing in all of these states, you're going to get a lot busier.
My goodness. Yes, we are getting busier. In fact, at my info sessions, I show a video that was made about a year ago that talks about our target states. And I have to apologize. I'm like, this video is out of date. We have Tennessee that's joined with us, like within Memphis and Nashville. And so just really across the country, we're seeing people really recognizing the power of choice and what it can mean for students.
That's great. We hope the whole map is recolored. We'll go back now to a little about you. Tell me about your own K through 12 education.
So I grew up in Napanee, Indiana, which is a small town of about 5,000 people in northern Indiana. So there really weren't any private school options around us, that you just went to the school that was there. I was fortunate in that my public school system was excellent, that I, even as I've gotten into, you know, visiting so many different private schools around the country and being involved with them, realizing that my upbringing there in public school was as good, if not better, than a lot of private schools. But I also, even in that, had the advantage of being able, I remember in elementary being part of, they call it gifted and talented education programs, which I really didn't like that name, especially now I don't like that name. But I was, you know, a couple of days a week able to be pulled out and have all these interesting experiences, the kinds of things that I actually see in really good high-performing private schools that students get to have. And so that kind of showed me like what education could be, and it's the kind of education I'd want every child to have an access to, like I had growing up.
And then later on, I understand you went to Bethel University. And what was your experience like there?
Yeah. So I went just down the road to, it was at the time Bethel College, now Bethel University in Mishawaka, Indiana. And it was a time where I double majored in mathematics and biblical studies because, you know, those two go together so well. I was interested actually in becoming a missionary overseas, and then shifted into really being interested in linguistics because I met my wife there and she's interested in ESL. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to get into linguistics, which then led me to do my master's and PhD in linguistics at Indiana University.
Wow. And then you went back and taught at Bethel. And I see across math, English, and linguistics. and launched a minor and a major in teaching English to speakers of other languages. That's quite significant. So along the way, while you did all of that, how did you become familiar with the Montessori model of education?
Yeah, so I think like many things in life, having children got me interested again in K-12 education. So on a more personal note, so I have two boys. My oldest now is actually will turn 17 this year. He's on the autism spectrum. And early on in school, the things were like a challenge starting in kindergarten and first grade and in public education. And the wheels just fell off spectacularly in second grade. But we ended up having to actually pull him out and try to homeschool for a bit. And we were just at a loss for what to do and what fit, because it was this case of where in the public school system, there were some wonderful teachers and wonderful administrators who were doing everything they could to try to help and serve us. But the system itself was really just broken and not set up to serve someone with the challenges that he has. And I was looking around trying to find a school. And here in town, there's a private Montessori school that went up to eighth grade. On a Sunday afternoon, I biked over to it and visited it and walked around, talked to teachers. I was like, this is amazing. I've never seen anything like this in terms of the way the classrooms were set up for students to move about and the self-directed learning and the emphasis on movement and being in the environment. And I thought, my goodness, I have to find a way to get my son here. And what happened with that was that they didn't take the vouchers. There's no access to it. But my wife was able to go from stay-at-home mom to being a professor at Notre Dame. And so that allowed us to pay for private education. And he was in there for a year. And the transformation I saw in him was astounding. The school he was at previously, we were getting a call by 9 a.m. of him having to go home. And here we were in an environment where he could be seen and worked with as who he was. Like, that was my sort of personal experience. But then as a professor, while I was teaching at Bethel, in one of my mathematics classes, I had a student who was a high school age student that was taking classes at the college as part of a REACH program for high school students. And this student was just, it was an algebra course. They were answering questions, not just in a sense of here's the right answer, but they were answering questions and then asking very thoughtful questions about some of the larger principles of the mathematics that we were talking. I was just incredibly impressed with them. And I asked them one time, I was like, have you had this before? Like, oh no, I've never taken this class before. I was like, huh. And then about a week after asking that question, I was at my son's Montessori school for a parent information night. I looked down the row and I saw my student sitting there who had been in his class. I'm like, hey, what are you doing here? And she's like, oh, this is where I went to school. And as I was just unpacking it, what I saw in Montessori education with the self-directed learning and the way you see the big picture of things, that it was really teaching students how to ask and answer big questions for themselves. And I was just, between my son's experience and experiencing that student, I was like, yeah, I'm a convert to this.
Tell me about your journey from higher education and what led you to then start the Montessori Consortium of the Great Lakes.
So it was actually at that same night where I was seeing that person that was there, the head of school at my son's school announced that night that they'd received this grant to be able to hire someone to build a consortium of Montessori schools to advance Montessori education in the region and research. And I heard that and was like, I think I should be a part of that, because in the back of my mind was, I was thinking, boy, I really wish there was a Montessori high school, because this school only went up to eighth grade. And I was also thinking at that time that, and pardon me if I get emotional in talking about this, but we felt trapped as a family trying to figure out how to help our son. And through a consortium and doing this, I saw an opportunity to help other families not feel trapped. To create opportunity. So, I mean, that's also the genesis of my passion for school choice, is because I feel like no family should ever feel that should be constrained by their finances for the future of their child. So I had a meeting with my academic dean to talk about my upcoming sabbatical, because I'd just been tenure at Bethel. And I walked into the meeting and actually said, I'm going to be resigning, and here's why. And actually spent some of the time about these same things I'm telling you, sharing with her. And at that point, that's where I left higher ed and moved into K-12 space with Montessori education.
You know, you definitely understand, because you and your wife are fortunate to have the ability to pay private school tuition.
My heart broke for those who didn't have that. No one should ever face that.
Exactly. Well, what led you then to start your own school, and particularly a high school? I see a lot of Montessori schools, but usually they're elementary. Why is that? And why do you think more high schools are needed in the Montessori tradition?
Well, first off, I think high schools are rare for a lot of reasons. For one, Maria Montessori didn't really specify out the level of specificity that was done up through sixth grade in her model, that everything at 7th through 12th grade is a bit more of a sketch of a philosophy and not a real clear roadmap for how to do it. And so folks haven't done that as much. Also with it, I don't think we see a lot of them because the expertise and flexibility needed in your faculty at the high school level to do the kind of self-directed learning is really takes an unusual multidisciplinary teacher to be able to work in that kind of environment. I also saw that, you know, it's interesting in education, each level with Montessori education, parents get less comfortable with Montessori the older students get, because when you're at the sort of preschool level, the self-directed learning is very exciting for parents. So like, look at what they're learning. But by the time you're getting to middle school and high school, you're staring at college on the horizon and you're thinking, do I trust this philosophy and this process to prepare my student for college or workforce? So I think for all those reasons, there aren't a lot of them. But for myself, I'm like, from what I saw with that student that I experienced in my classroom in West Houston, I'm like, we kind of need this. And actually, I think we need more of them, because I think Montessori high schools, I think they work for students wherever they are on the distribution of things. But I think they are fantastic for students who are, I would say, in the tails of the, I don't know, however you want to define it, academic ability distribution or whatever you have it in terms of distributions of students. I look at the school that I started and co-founded with Eileen Mariani, who was my son's teacher at the other Montessori school, that in a Montessori high school environment, students who are, say, you know, as freshmen ready to be doing college courses, like there's no ceiling on what they can accomplish in an environment like that. And I could tell all kinds of stories from the ones already just in our first few years of students we have. But it's also the kind of environment where students who have challenges can be seen for who they are and be with the same teachers for 4 years and get an opportunity to really maximize their potential and to really lean into the unique skills that they can bring to education that can get lost in a more traditional structure.
How do you think this fits with college admission policies? Because they can be very structured and not necessarily, I mean, it is higher education, but they also don't seem to necessarily allow for that kind of freedom and creativity when they're deciding who to admit. It's very much, you will have this test score and this GPA. And as far as I know about Montessori schools, there are no real grades traditionally anyway. Do you think college admissions policies need to change to reflect changes in K-12 education?
Oh, that is a great question. So in designing the assessment frameworks for the high school, and thinking ahead to transcripting and colleges and how do we bridge that gap? You know, this is an ongoing discussion at our high school where I see it evolving, and it'll be interesting to see also how admissions offices evolve over time. But a couple points, like one, we really have seen a move with colleges to go to a test optional approach to things. And colleges and universities have been also admitting homeschool students for a long time and have processes like that. So our students have kind of like that framework they can go through. But we belong to something called the Mastery Transcript Consortium. What it is a mastery-based skills transcript that students develop a portfolio of material that demonstrates what skills they have. So as an accredited high school in Indiana, our students are getting all the standards and content through that go with an Indiana Core 40 diploma, but it's being done within a cross-curricular frame that shows that they have mastery of skills of, like, and we have skills that are not even just academic skills, but things like resiliency and such. And they have, through the Mastery Transcript Consortium, this is a digital transcript that college admissions officers can view. And so we actually have our first seniors this year in the school, three of them. And they're, at this point, I'd have to go talk to my co-founder, Eileen, because I'm not on the ground anymore at the high school, but they've all been getting accepted into the schools that are their first choices that they've been having. So it's been pretty exciting to see that already coming to fruition.
Now, once you decided to start your school, how did you learn about the Drexel Fund?
So I wish I could say that it was like through due diligence of me searching and finding good partners that could be with us. And that is absolutely not it. It was very relational. And I'm learning that this is a common story, that somebody I know who had toured through the Montessori school I was at when I was building a consortium and was being their development director, came through and visited the school and I got to know them. And then a year later, they started a wildflower school in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is a micro Montessori school, part of the Wildflower Network. And they'd gotten funding from the Drexel Fund. And this person had heard that we'd been working towards for a couple of years of trying to launch a Montessori high school in South Bend and going through the process of due diligence on that, and figure out how to make it happen. And she said, hey, let me introduce you to this person at the Drexel Fund. I think they might be interested in what you're doing. I was like, great. I had a phone call for an hour with one of the partners during the summertime. And at the end of the call, the partner said, hey, I think what you're doing would be a good fit for our founders program, and invited me to apply. And the rest, history from there.
What was that application process like?
Rigorous, I think, is probably the first word that comes to mind. So it's a 3-round process. The first round is an online application that has, I believe it's 10 questions, you know, asking about school model and such, and getting just a feel for where a person is at in the journey. Because our founders program is not for a person who's just starting the journey. It's somebody who's been working on it and trying to figure out and is it's gone beyond just an idea at that point. So there was a first round application. And then based on that, I was invited to participate in the second round, which had about a 5 to 10 page document that were another 10 to 12 questions that were much more detailed that I had to lay out, as well as an initial budget template that was filled out for it and provided references, a video interview where I had to role play or answer different questions. So fairly intense at that point. And then after that, I was invited to the third round of the process, which had some additional questions, but also involved a site visit from at that time, the current director of the Founders Program. They met my current employers, went through our prospective sites that we were looking at for the school. And then it was after that point that they extended an invitation to join the program.
That's a real honor, because that's a very rigorous selection process.
Just getting out of the first round for the Founders Program, a person should feel really good about themselves. And even say, I mean, a plug for our Founders Program, just the process of applying for the program, I felt like moved me forward in the process of thinking about my school. Because even just the questions I was asked made me go, oh, I need to think about that. It was a very, very happy day when they invited me to be a part of the program.
So it sounds a little like Shark Tank. Even if you don't get a deal on Shark Tank, you often get advice and guidance to help you move forward in your business.
Yeah, absolutely. And the neat thing about Drexel Fund and even that process is I feel like the Drexel Fund very seldom says no to people. More often, it's like, not yet. And you learn, oh, what do I need to do next for it? So there's a lot of people who apply for the Founders Program and first time around, they may make it to the second round or even someone I know made it to the third round, but then didn't get into the program, but then in a following year or a later year did get into the program.
Well, part of the process involves mentoring. And who was your mentor and what was the most valuable thing this person helped you learn?
So at the time, the director of the Founders Program was a guy by the name of Bill Olson, and he'd worked a lot in the charter school space and starting things up. And one thing I learned from him was that it is so critically important that you are clear on what your school model is and what your school vision is, and that you can articulate it in sort of short, succinct statements. And then that as you make every decision about your school, you are going back and using that vision, that mission, that model to answer any question that you have about what you're doing. Everything from how are you designing your policies and human resources to what are you hanging on the walls? Like physically, what does your space look like when a person walks into it? How is everything in your school pointing towards the mission, the vision, and the model? You know, I started a micro Montessori high school, but I took a lot away from, Bill took us to some schools, the Noble Prep schools in Chicago that he worked in, and I walked around then. And you can almost imagine a school model that is as fundamentally different from a Montessori environment that you can get is that kind of high-performing college prep model there. And I took so much away from that, seeing how mission and vision and model played itself out in everything that happened in that school. And so I think that's one thing he taught me, and that's something I keep trying to pass on to everybody that I work with.
How is the school doing today?
It's doing really well. Actually, I had coffee this morning with Eileen, my co-founder, and talking it through. We're looking at next year. So the school I designed was at maturity will be a 60 to 65 student school. Right now they're at 39 students in their third year. They'll probably be about 52 to 55 students next year. It's been really neat to see. I mean, not without challenges. I mean, school startup is hard, but it's going well. And what I'm excited about is I feel like the school that I helped start is really blazing the path for others to come behind it, so they can find their own ways, their own problems and mess ups, if you will.
You know, a lot of educators are very skilled in pedagogy and teaching, but they don't know a whole lot about the business side. That's probably the hardest part for them, you know, where they need to really learn.
And I wouldn't say it is possible to learn. That's the other thing that one thing I like about our fellowship is that it helps you find out what is it you don't know or don't know you don't know. And it's not that we sort of teach people how to start schools, but we create a space by which a person has the capacity to learn all the things they don't know and that sort of time and the money to invest in it so they can get that knowledge.
One of the things we found out earlier this year when we were doing a series of stories on teacher training, teacher prep and education colleges is none of them are teaching majors how to start their own schools. I mean, they're not even saying you need to go over to the College of Business and take a few courses over there to add to your education major. It's just not there. Do you see that changing, or, you know, obviously you think it needs to change?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that, about an adjustment in higher education to saying that school entrepreneurship is something that we should be creating an explicit educational path for. But boy, I think that'd be fascinating if a college or university wanted to head that direction. I think a lot of the things that are in startup of a school are things that could also serve a person no matter what they do. Like I'm a big fan of diverse educational training because the way our world works now is that you are shifting careers so quickly, it seems like. So yeah, I would love to see something like that. So if anybody listening or it's a college university would like to talk about that, I'd be happy to give my thoughts on that.
Maybe Drexel could branch out and help a college of education start that track. Who knows? Speaking of Drexel, what inspired you to make that move from the school founder and head of school and everything to join the Drexel Fund staff?
There were two parts. So I feel like any move in life is a push-pull that happens. In the case of me moving from being on the ground, founding a school to being with the Drexel Fund, one thing about it was that the school I started is, it's within the Wildflower Network of schools, and they're teacher-led schools. They're designed to be having the administrative work distributed among the teachers. And I knew myself being a founder who designed so many operational systems that had been such a big decision maker when it was super small and just starting. Because my first year, I taught mathematics and was doing all the administrative things. So I was like the math teacher that first year. I knew the longer I was on the ground, it was not going to get to the vision of a true teacher-led school if I was still there. Everyone would look at me as being like, oh, Eric's the decision maker on everything. So I just knew that I needed to sort of back myself out intentionally to make it healthier for the long haul and to really be a model. So that was kind of what had me, I told my co-founder, and she'd known this coming into it, that I said I was like at least 2 years on the ground, but then after that, I'll just be board of directors and then I'll roll myself off the board of directors. So the Drexel Fund, some folks there found out that that was my plan. And it was actually a year ago yesterday that they approached me about it and offered it. And it was this position in founders program, and it was a very easy yes for me. Because number one, everybody who's at the Drexel Fund is just passionate about helping underserved communities have more opportunities. And I also, for myself, having gone through the winding career path that I'd gone through and started a school and experienced that, I at least know for the next few years, I have fresh enough knowledge that maybe I can help others. And I mean, it traces back to this internal feeling I have of no parent should feel trapped by their education options. And by working with the Drexel Fund, I feel like I have an opportunity to help others, the other parents, not feel trapped by helping people found new schools that serve their communities.
In your current role, what trends are you seeing among potential founders or people who are trying to open schools?
Well, the one big trend I see is that there's a lot of people wanting to start new schools. I think the pandemic, one thing it did is that it created a moment of time where it disrupted everyone's thinking about education for at least a moment and made us realize there's more ways we could do this. And some of the ways we have been doing it for a long time are not exactly robust if we run into, say, like something like the pandemic, but it created a time of questioning. So I think there's a strong entrepreneurial spirit, and I think we're going to be seeing, especially as school choice programs and access to them expand across the country, that we're going to see a lot more folks trying to start schools. The other part is that the other trend I see is that I think there are a lot of tools out there now that lower the barriers to entrance to starting a school. And what I mean by that is that when you look at even, let's take payroll or insurance benefits or all these technical things that at one time you may have had to have a full-time staff member to do just that thing, that there's a lot of automated platforms that simplify it to where you can create more streamlined staffing setups with schools, which in turn lowers the amount of fundraising or tuition or students you have to get to, that we can get to like smaller and smaller schools. I am seeing a lot of people wanting to start micro schools these days.
What is the biggest challenge founders are having? One of the things we're seeing, and you may be seeing something different, but is getting a building or a facility approved.
Absolutely. Facilities. It's funny you should say that. So I had a virtual information session a couple nights ago, and I had like three of my four current founders were on that. And I basically put that out there. I said, like, these people are wanting to start a school. What would you tell them based on what you've learned in the last 7 months of what you've been doing? And to a person, they all said, facilities. Like, it takes forever to find a spot that is going to check all the boxes, that can get through all the approvals. And that's probably the number one holdup that a lot of folks have. So, I mean, my encouragement to somebody is that you start looking almost right away, because a part of the looking process is you have to kind of go through and figure out what's not going to work. But you also have to know your model so well to know, like, what are the characteristics that I'm going to need in a facility. For myself, we spent two and a half years looking at a spot. We had three spots that pretty much fell through, like got far in the process, but fell through before we got to our spot that we opened in. So it's not the only thing people need, but I think that's one of the biggest hangups.
Yeah. And every locality is different with zoning rules and land use and all of that. In fact, someplace down in South Florida, one of the counties requires you to be licensed as a child care center.
That's the other part, is that it's very local. I mean, one of my founders joked to, like, you will get to know your fire marshal very well.
Yeah. And your zoning administrator. Yep. In some cases, your Department of Children and Families inspector. Among these people that you all assist and accept into your program, are there certain personality traits that these applicants seem to share? I'm just curious.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this one will probably won't surprise you, but resilience is one thing actually looks for in application. I'm actually interested in what has a person tried and failed at, because starting a school involves hearing a lot of no's from people and having a lot of, there's no straight line to opening a school. And you have all kinds of existential moments along the way of like, if this doesn't happen or we can't get through this, we're toast. Like it. And then you even have to have those moments of where you think you're toast, but you brush yourself off and say, okay, it's not going that way. We're now going to go this way. So that's one big thing I notice about successful founders. Another is that there's a deep optimism inside there, that even in the face of something that's challenging, not a foolish optimism, but just a like, I believe in this and I'm going to get there. Another part is a true, deep, almost inevitable belief that they're going to get their school open. And that actually only comes from truly knowing what kind of school you're wanting to open. Like when I was in graduate school working on my PhD, I noticed there were two types of people there getting PhDs. Well, there were two types for a little while. It was people who were in love with the idea of getting a PhD, and those for whom getting that PhD was a means to an end and is just a part of the process and is a step along the way. I think school startup can sometimes be like that. Sometimes people can be like, I'm kind of in love with the idea of starting school and being a principal, and I'm going to see this with our, you know, kids in the building. But there is really just they're in love with the idea of that, that it's not a deep burning passion of like, I think the kids in my community need this school, and particular for us because we serve underserved communities, like I'm going to be the one, my school is going to provide them possibilities and options that they're not going to get otherwise. And like that gas in the tank, like that, that helps a person, I think, be successful. And they honestly, last one, they've got to be self sort of directed and self-motivated. A question came up once in an intro session, the way it was phrased was, so the Drexel Fund Founders Program helps you start a school or teaches you how to start a school? It's like, well, no, we provide the space and the opportunities for you to start a school. Like that's, we're a sort of environmental facilitator. We're not the doer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you're more like an incubator.
Mm-hmm. I could view, I mean, you know, you're in the South, so you're in SEC country. I kind of look at it that it's like you're on the 1 yard line in football and you're going to hand off to the running back or like the quarterback's going to QB sneak it. And you've got your 280-pound fullback who's going to grab them and try to shove them across the line, because we can do that now. That's, it's like the Reggie Bush years against Notre Dame. That's beside the point. But we can, you know, pick them up and shove them across the line. We're the 280-pound fullback who's shoving somebody across the line. Like, we're going to help them get there.
Right. But they've still got the ball.
They've still got the ball. And they're like, we're going to give them a shove, but they're carrying the ball.
What is Drexel's track record as it regards schools that have remain successful long term, and how long, or is there a length of time schools need to stay open to be called successful? In other words, what does success look like?
There's a lot of different ways we think about success in terms of schools opening, closing. I'd have to actually go dig up the numbers. We really had very few schools who have closed or founders who their school didn't make it, but we're also only 7 years, 8 years old as a fund. So we're still early on in this. When I think about success, you know, you look at our some of our pillars, like we want to help private schools start that serve underserved communities and that are high performing. Like a school for us actually to support, at least 1/3 of the seats have to be seats that qualify for free or reduced lunch. Our portfolio average is actually around 72% of the seats that we've created go to kids who qualify for free or reduced lunch. And so in that sense, I think we've been very successful in our track record of creating opportunities for underserved populations. Looking ahead, we're always trying to create more seats. We organize ourselves actually according to the quote unquote funds. So we've had a first fund that was 4 years, a second fund that is 5 years that we're currently in, and we're in our plans for a third fund. Between fund one and fund two, we've created almost 15,000 new seats in the last 7 years. So for us being successful is also continuing to create more seats.
That's quite a lot for a fund that is less than 10 years old. Where do you see the future of the Drexel Fund, especially now that more and more states are approving education choice programs and making it possible for these new programs to start?
As states continue to not just get programs, but those programs become established to the point of where they're unlikely to be pushed back, I see us operating in more states. So if folks go on the website, they'll actually see a list of opportunity states and target states to get a sense of, you know, we're keeping an eye nationally on things because we do isolate our investments to our target states predominantly, just because another part of funding schools is we only fund schools that at maturity, no more than 15% of their operating budget comes from philanthropy. That's our measure of financial sustainability for it. So I definitely see us expanding outwards. We're all looking west at Arizona, what they're doing, and seeing if that holds up with their ESAs. Even in Indiana right now, it's interesting to watch what's happening in terms of our own expansion. So I think the future is bright for private education. And one thing I would say is that this may sound odd coming from me because I'm so into school choice and private school model, is that my hope for the future is seeing legislators saying, you know what? We need good public schools, good charter schools, good private schools, because they are all serving different populations in different ways. And some are better at serving some populations than others. I'm a hopeful optimist, and I'm hopeful that we're seeing a time in education where we're going to get investment across all those areas.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. This has been a great conversation, and you've offered us a lot of insight about the Drexel Fund and where folks can go, because we have more and more of them contacting us and saying they want to start schools, a good place they can go and learned some valuable lessons. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure, Lisa. Thank you for inviting me on.